It's your Tuesday daily delivery. I am Michael Rand. Glad to be back for another day. Hope everyone's doing well out there. Really good show coming up. Ben Kaplan, co-author of a book that comes out today called Pipeline to the Pros, How D3 Small College Nobodies Rose to Rule the NBA, will be my guest here in just a little bit. Really interesting book that, like I said, comes out today. Has a large section on Timberwolves head coach Chris Finch. Also some interesting stuff in there on the old Minneapolis Lakers and connections to what are now Division III college athletic programs as well. So you will want to listen to that to get some extra insights into Chris Finch and just the interesting world of the NBA and how many decision makers, head coaches come from Division III institutions and played at Division III colleges. Get to a little bit of Vikings draft stuff at the end of the show, inching towards that, just 9 days away. Can't get here soon enough, by the way. And by the way, also, Tom Curran, insider for NBC Sports, from covers the Patriots, will be my guest, expected to be my guest on Wednesday's show. So that will be some good draft talk on Wednesday tomorrow, talking about the Vikings, the Patriots. Is there any chance they can trade up to number 3? Tom will have a lot of insights into that. First, though, what did I miss? I want to talk Twins and WNBA draft. I'm only going to start with the Twins because I feel like we're at an interesting point in their season. WNBA draft certainly was interesting, and I will get to that in just a minute. But Twins, kind of a microcosm of a lot of the concerns that I had about this team going into the season, came to a head yesterday. They've been building for this whole season. 15 games in now, they're 6-9. 15 games in, you know, playing at a 400 clip. That is not good baseball. They seem overmatched a lot of nights against really good teams. Baltimore, certainly a really good team. That's who they played yesterday, losing 7-4. But my concerns are these. Number one, that they were counting very heavily on second-year players to replicate the success that they had in 2023. And, right, like, you can't go into a season being pessimistic about that, right? You say, okay, this is what we got out of them as a rookie. Let's keep this going. We should expect to keep this going. On the flip side, we've seen so many instances of sophomore slumps, whatever you want to call it, the league adjusting to a player, especially to hitters, figuring out, okay, what do they do well? What are their strengths? What are their weaknesses? And then turning around and having more success against that player in their second season. Louis Varland, starting pitcher on Monday night's game, came in to the season. You know, Twins had some high expectations, right? Is he going to be a starter? Is he going to be a reliever? They thought he could excel in either role. They put him into the rotation because they figured, hey, we've got enough bullpen depth. They don't have enough starting pitching depth. And now he's 0-3 with an ERA of almost 9. He's just not making the pitches he needs, especially with the chance to finish hitters off. Here was manager Rocco Baldelli talking about that being a big problem in Monday's game when he gave up 6 runs, albeit only 4 of them earned.
I could call it 2-strike execution for Lou. Lou's stuff was good tonight. I think he had actually pretty good feel for what he was doing. He threw the ball well, and that's why it can be frustrating. It can be really frustrating when you feel like you do the vast majority of your job really well as a starting pitcher and you're still giving up runs. They are a dangerous lineup. If you make mistakes, regardless of count, you know, they will get to a lot of those mistakes. And they have a lot of left-handed hitters that that do a good job. But the right-handed hitters on their side had good at-bats today, too. It's a tough lineup to navigate. So the two-strike execution with the breaking balls especially has to be better than what it is. And in a straight up way, it's what I talked to Lou about. I actually don't do that in the dugout very often, but it's multiple starts in a row where he threw the ball reasonably well, but needs to make better pitches when he gets to 2 strikes. You know, those pitches that are in the middle of the zone, those are not quality pitches. They might be in different counts, but not in those counts.
And again, that's a small sample size for Varland. We're willing to see if he can turn that around, but ultimately his best role might be in the bullpen. Problem is this year, I don't know if that's exactly where they need him. They need arms in the rotation because they are pretty thin there after not doing much in the offseason, losing Sonny Gray, losing Kenta Maeda, and then only adding Anthony DeSclafani, who was hurt right away and won't pitch probably this whole season. So The pitching depth not there. Varlin being counted on to be a starter, not being able to replicate the success he had last year. Now, I mentioned that there were two unearned runs in this game Monday. Edward Julian, another one of those excellent rookies from a year ago, is hitting 200, albeit with a much better OPS than that would suggest, almost 800. He has hit some home runs lately, but strikeouts have been an issue. Taking called third strikes have been an issue, and he made an error in Monday's game that led to those two runs. Could have ended the inning, should have been a double play ball. Instead, nothing, and they end up giving up two runs to Baltimore. Changes the complexion of the game. So he has not had a great start to the year. He's had an okay start, in especially with the power. He's got four home runs now, but he has not had a great start to the year by any stretch of the imagination. Matt Wallner, a guy who they were counting on to be a left-handed power bat, he struck out in two-thirds of his official at-bats this season, 16 out of 24 official at-bats. Hit a home run the other day, but that was off of a position player pitching. That's his only home run this year. Needs to figure out his swing, needs to have more productive, better at-bats than what he's been having this season. So all of those guys they were counting on, the biggest one, of course, Royce Lewis. That's not his fault. He got hurt. He got hurt in the first game of the season, third inning of the season. He looked like he was ready for another, big breakout year, but injuries are kind of part of his story at this point, so you got to worry about that too. The sophomore slump, not getting enough out of these second-year players, is driving a lot of what is wrong with the Twins right now, and some of that's just on the players. Some of that, though, is planning. Some of that is you have to know there could be some regression here. Even if you want to believe in these players, if you want to believe that this is sustainable, there is going to be regression, and I feel like maybe they didn't factor enough of that into their 2024 planning. WNBA draft, meanwhile, was Monday night. Shocker of all shockers, Indiana takes Caitlin Clark of Iowa. What are they doing? Ah, just kidding, of course. That was the no-brainer of all time, selling out games everywhere. She's going to be on TV. She was just on Saturday Night Live. She's just kind of everywhere. I'm curious to see how her game translates into the WNBA. I'm sure she's going to be great, but how it's different now, how when you're going against pro athletes, won't have the ball in your hands quite as much, won't be depended on quite as much, how she adjusts, how dominant she can be at this next level versus how she was in college. But an all-time great in college, she's going to be a great pro. Indiana had the easiest decision of any team in any draft that I can remember in a very long time, Caitlin Clark going one overall. The rest of the draft was a little bit of a mystery. Although props to Kent Youngblood, Star Tribune, he nailed the 7-8 picks. Nailed Chicago after trading with the Lynx, taking Angel Reese from LSU. And the Lynx at number 8, taking Alyssa Peely from Utah. Gives them some scoring possibilities. The Lynx needed a lot right there. They were okay last year. They were 19-21. But if you look deeper into the analytics, into the team, the team dynamics, they were 10th in net rating, 10th in defensive rating, 8th in offensive rating. This is more of an offensive player than a defensive player right now. Peely brings a unique offensive skill set to the Lynx that they certainly can use. That's kind of why they got her. That's why they drafted her. That's what they're looking for. They're hoping to build her into a adequate WNBA defensive player, but really looking to capitalize on her offense. We'll see if they're able to do that. See if they're able to carve an identity out of offense in 2024 and beyond. They're always going to want to play both sides of the ball, of course, but it looks like this pick was made with getting better on offense in mind, maybe creating a certain identity around that, pairing her down low with Nafisa Collier, giving them some more scoring punch to take away some of the stress that's been put on Collier in the last couple of seasons. Happy to be joined today by Ben Kaplan, one of two authors, along with Danny Parkins, of recent book Pipeline to the Pros, How D3 Small College Nobodies Rose to Rule the NBA. Ben, how you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for doing this, and congrats on the book. Looking forward to hearing more about it, and maybe basically we start with, how did you and Danny come up with this idea to kind of connect the dots with so many of these kind of D3 connections forming enough of a thread to make a book?
Yeah, so I played Division III basketball for a couple of years at Amherst College in Massachusetts, and started noticing guys that I played with, guys who coached me, guys that I played against, rising up the ranks pretty quickly in the NBA. And that paired with Brad Stevens' rise first at Butler, and then as he transitioned over to the NBA, and his backstory was pretty widely shared, and knew that he was a DePauw grad and played Division III basketball. So the combination of those things made us wonder, how deep does this really go? And then once we started looking into it, it was shocking. We started working on this project in late 2020, and in the 2020-2021 season, 12 of the 30 NBA teams had a general manager and/or a head coach that had played Division III basketball. So nearly half the teams in the league. So from there, we were like, this is something that we would want to know why. And then with my background in the Division III world and partnering with Danny, who's one of my best and oldest friends, who's a Chicago radio host and has media connections and that profile, we partnered together to work on this project.
What is the why? Before we get into some of the obvious Minnesota connections to this, like talk me through some of the why, because when you say 12 out of 30, that does really jump out at me, and maybe let's talk through the why first.
Yeah, it's a combination of building out the right skill set at the right time, and then also having the right connections. So a combination of a few like pretty big trees. Jeff Van Gundy's a Division III guy. He hired in or worked with guys like Tom Thibodeau, Steve Clifford. He is responsible, although he never worked with his brother Stan, he's responsible for Stan's job in the NBA at first. So having his guys kind of rise up at the same time that Greg Popovich, who wasn't a Division III player but coached at a Division III school and started hiring more Division III guys, and that led to Mike Budenholzer, Sam Presti, Will Hardy. So both those trees kind of like coming to fruition at a time when the skill set of someone who played basketball at a high enough level stopped playing competitively at a young age, so they were able to train in the coaching world and the management world as those
Interesting.
things got more complex. And then also just playing Division III basketball, you're not doing it for money, you're not doing it for fame, you're not getting a scholarship at a Division III school, at least not an athletic one. Sometimes there are big crowds at D3 games, but sometimes you're playing in front of a couple people at most. So to love basketball at that level and understand that I'm doing this for a really intrinsic gain, that translates well when you're doing an entry level job. Even in the NBA, entry level jobs aren't the most glamorous. You're not working with players, you're not on the road, you're grinding pretty hard. So to have that background seems to translate well.
I think you spoke just now to some of the skill set that would translate. How did your own Division III playing experience inform some of kind of how you wanted to approach this, other than, like you said before, seeing a lot of the people around you rising up? Like what about your experience informed some of what you wanted to write about?
I think just understanding, when I was at Amherst, it was a really good program. We were my first year playing, we were the defending national champions on the Division III level. And even then, the school had two basketball gyms. In the fall, the main gym was being used by the volleyball team. And then we had to fight with fencing club, ultimate frisbee club, like just to get gym time. We weren't treated any differently. We didn't have special fall and spring workouts. We were handling all that ourselves. So knowing that on a firsthand basis and understanding the motivation that it takes and just how unglamorous it really can be kind of helped frame it from our side.
Does that kind of like, oh, so scrappy gets to be kind of this un, you know, almost becomes like a pejorative at some point when you're talking about that. But this kind of like D3 athletes, by and large, you are relatable. They're kind of normal. In fact, I think even in the book, you talk about how, the coaches who come from this rank tend to be just kind of like relatable, normal people, like Chris Finch, who we'll get to in a little bit here with the Timberwolves. Does that kind of characterize a lot of what you see in these people who have risen to these positions of prominence, that even as they have become, elevated to the highest levels of the NBA, they still are relatable, normal, regular people?
There's definitely a humility to it that I think is innate in that level. Like if you're playing at the Division III level, someone's told you you're not good enough. Nobody grows up dreaming of playing Division III basketball. Like you want to get a scholarship, you want to play at a big D1 school, you want to play in the NCAA tournament. So you've already kind of been knocked down a little bit. I think that that certainly helps, especially in a occupation where you're going to get beat up a lot and you're going to have to take a lot of lumps. But yeah, I mean, that humility, as the jobs have gotten more complex and you need to do more learning, you can't just come in and say it's my way or the highway, especially when you're dealing with players. It certainly helps.
D3 schools often do tend to also be really good, prestigious academic schools. You just talked about Amherst, obviously a great reputation there. Chris Finch went to Princeton. Do you think that element of it plays into this as well? Like, hey, you guys are a lot of smart guys too.
Yeah, there was definitely a shift. Like early on, some of the D3 guys that came in, when you look at someone like a Jeff Van Gundy or Steve Clifford or Tom Thibodeau, they went to schools, East Coast schools, a lot of them were public schools, where there was a heavy focus on education. So they were training to be teachers. And that becomes a really portable skill as you go into coaching because so much of coaching is teaching. And then as we've gotten into the more recent years, you do see people coming from like, elite liberal arts schools like Chris Finch at Franklin and Marshall, Kobe Altman, the general manager of the Cavs, went to Middlebury College. People who had like kind of a well-rounded educational background where they learn how to think and they learn how to learn and they learn how to, can take a lot of information, condense it, and share it in a digestible format, which is really a lot of the job today.
I misspoke. You're right. Chris Finch did not end up going to Princeton. Obviously, he was going to go to Princeton, and then there was a little detour along the way. And that's maybe kind of a fun part of that story that we should get into now, and just kind of the rise of Chris Finch. And he had quite a journey, obviously, from Division III to now being one of the most successful coaches this season in the NBA playoffs, right around the corner for, one of the most successful seasons in Timberwolves history. As you think about his path, what stands out to you?
He was never expecting to be an NBA head coach. He was expecting to be a small college coach or a high school coach. That was the world he knew. That was where he expected to be. And then, he was going to go right into coaching after school. He had an opportunity to play overseas that took him to England where he played and then coached. And then he was trying to get back and coach Division III basketball. And I think one of my favorite stories from the book is that he was interviewing at a school in New York, New Paltz, one of the state schools in New York State, and they ended up passing on him. And he was willing to take that job and take what was a pretty significant pay cut from what he was making coaching overseas. And from that point, he was like, you know what, I'm going to stop trying to get my way back. I'm just going to dominate in Europe and see what I can do here. And ultimately, that led to the things that led to the things that led to him becoming the head coach of the Minnesota Timberwolves.
But there are a lot of steps along the way. I mean, you think about someone who goes from like a successful NBA playing career to then becoming a coach. Like there might only be that one step or like a step along. You might have to be an NBA assistant coach, but like your path, everybody knows who you are. Like thinking about a lot of these guys, you have to connect a lot of dots. And especially in Chris Finch's case, there were a lot of dots to connect along the way just to get him anywhere near here.
Yeah, it's really, we tried in this story not to shy away from the element that luck plays in all of these stories and in anyone's story. There's all these business books out there that tell you the secret to success. And if you do these three or four things that successful person A did, then you'll be successful too. And getting back to that humility, I think a lot of these people that we spoke to were very forthright in saying, I'm so lucky. Like there are so many coaches at the high school level, the Division III level that are just as good as I am. They just didn't get the breaks I did. But at the same time, like they had to be equipped to take advantage of that. And so these are still like very special talents. There's just way more than 30 of them in the world.
I would imagine Chris Finch probably ruminates about, how his journey been different if he had wound up at Princeton or if different things along the way had been different. What, as you think about his particular story, how is it unique, but how does it also mirror a lot of the experiences that you've seen from some of these other coaches who have risen from D3 to now be, heavily involved in top jobs in the NBA?
Yeah, so Chris Finch was he was thinking that he was going to end up at Princeton, and then Pete Carril, the famed Princeton coach, ended up getting access to a different recruit who had some D1 offers that got pulled at the last minute, and had to call up Chris and be like, "Hey, we got a different guy in." That guy ended up being really good. It wasn't the wrong call, And so that led to Chris's route to Division III, which isn't something that he was planning on doing. That's really similar to Jeff Van Gundy, who initially, when he was going to college, went to Yale, and then they told him that, he wasn't going to have a spot on the team, and he ended up transferring a few different times. He was the transfer portal before the transfer portal, and he ended up at a couple Division III schools playing. All those guys, like, none of this could have been planned. There's no way they could have, like, sketched out, okay, I do 2 years here, I do a good job, and then I get 2 years here, and then I do a good job, and then 2 years here, and I get a good job. Like, it was so many different lucky breaks. What they all have in common is that they embraced the jobs they had in the moment they had them and did as good of a job as they possibly could, so that, if those opportunities did arise, like, they had people that could vouch for them and they had a track record of success.
Does it, does it force or enable coaches like that to become, better tacticians at a certain level because they can't just rely on reputation and things like that? I mean, think about Chris Finch, a guy who came here with, I believe, more of a reputation as an offensive head coach, guy who's going to kind of put the pieces together on offense. But, he gets there, he runs a really good system still here too. But obviously, you get Rudy Gobert in, you've got a guy like Jaden McDaniels, you've got kind of a defensive unit now that's built around, their team now is built more around defense. So they're adaptable. He knows how to put the defensive pieces together too. Like, I feel like maybe along the way, somewhere in there, he had to learn how to be a shapeshifter, but also, like you said, humble enough to know it can't just be one way. If I've got personnel to do something, I can't just have it, I can't just run my systems or pretend that I'm going to take a defensive team and make them an offensive team.
Yeah, so much of his coaching style in Europe was inventions of necessity. He didn't have big guys, so he had to figure out how to spread the floor and shoot a lot of threes and play fast. And because he's doing that, which caters to the talent that he has on the team, that catches the eye of the Houston Rockets, who are trying to play that way. And then they hire him in to their G League program to run that, and be their head coach. He wasn't someone that was starting with the numbers and starting from an analytical bent. He was starting with, okay, here's the roster that was dumped in my lap. I got to figure out how to win with this. You see that a lot. Like, you're not going to get in and reload talent when you're coaching at the Division III level, or when you're coaching overseas, or when you're coaching at, a G League team. Like, you're going to have roster turnover, you're going to have different skill sets, and you're just going to need to make chicken salad out of chicken, you know what, sometimes.
Absolutely. And I think he had to do that initially until at least they kind of had the pieces more in place here. But, somebody who has the ability to kind of do that, to adapt to injuries. I mean, they were without Karl-Anthony Towns for a long time down the stretch this season, but they learned to play differently, things of that nature. But how he even got the job here, was it like Ryan Saunders gets fired basically mid-year. We're still kind of in the COVID era, kind of trying to come out of that. He gets hired off of another team's staff as an assistant. Like, that just never happens. It shows you how much Gerson Rosas, then the president of the Wolves, wanted him, how much he thought of him from his Houston days, but also just that's such an unconventional path. You have to know people and have put in the work to get that kind of opportunity.
Yeah, and that's where, the value of connections in any job, but in the coaching world, the NBA world, it's a small community. And, he was able to form a great bond with Gerson Rosas, with the Rockets, and especially with the Rockets G League team as they were building up that program. You go through that work together and, like, have those war stories from the G League and see what you're capable of in that type of environment. When you're working with someone who ends up in a bigger job, like, they're more likely to pull you along. And that's a consistent theme that we've seen with a lot of these guys.
I'm sure Wolves fans would love this, but I mean, you guys probably love this for the sake of your book. What if it was Wolves Celtics in the finals, Chris Finch against Brad Stevens?
Yeah, that would be great. There's a lot of potential Division III connections out there. Yeah, that Wolves Celtics one would be a good one. We're looking down the future of maybe the Jazz start building, and we've got Will Hardy, and with how good Wembanyama's looked, Popovich will be back there. And yeah, definitely, it's not hard to find the Division III connections for some of the teams that are going to have success.
Royal Credit Union smart checking accounts offer no monthly fees and no minimum balance. Enjoy financial freedom when you open your Royal Credit Union smart checking account online at rcu.org/gochecking. Insured by NCUA.
I want to ask you a couple kind of old Minneapolis Lakers questions here in a minute because I know there's a lot of connections there, but just getting away from being too provincial here and focusing on Chris Finch and just talking about the book in general, like what were some of your other favorite stories to tell coaches, GMs who have kind of risen from the ranks and maybe even, you know, those that stand out even from the rest?
Yeah, so the Division III level was founded 50 years ago, but one of the things that we decided to do with the book was take guys that had played basketball at schools that eventually became Division III and kind of pull them under our umbrella. And that allowed us to talk about, you know, not only some people with Minnesota ties, but also some people who I had never heard of, even as a huge NBA fan, that had a tremendous impact on the league. So that's someone like Carl Scheer, who the Denver Nuggets used to be the Denver Rockets, and then he took over, rebranded them, built them up in the ABA, was a key figure in getting the ABA to merge with the NBA, created the dunk contest, created All-Star Weekend. Like all these things that we take for granted as NBA fans was there because of someone with a small college background. And there were several others like that that were so interesting to learn about and fun to share those stories.
Okay, so now about the Lakers, that you gave me a good entree into that. Who, you know, you're right. A lot of those schools back in, you know, the 40s and 50s, that wasn't Division III yet, but a lot of schools like Hamlin, which was now a Division III school, that was a big kind of powerhouse here back in the day, kind of formed some of the pipeline for the early Lakers teams. What did you kind of learn from some of the research you did into the Minneapolis Lakers and the role that what would become D3 schools played in their founding?
Yeah, the NBA, it's not that old. It's a little over 75 years old, and
People forget that, don't they? It's like it feels like it's been around forever, but it is a relatively new league compared to, you know, all the other major leagues, really.
yeah, it's so new, and it's so like we don't have to go that far back to think of a time when nothing was like given to the NBA, and it was really a fledgling league, and you know, who knew if it was going to succeed, and certain teams were fighting off bankruptcy all the time. So the role of a general manager was really more focused on getting butts in the seats, publicity. Building a winning team and a successful team was more secondary to the goal of selling out tickets and being a successful business. And it's so interesting now that we've almost shifted so far in the other direction where you're focused so much on basketball, sometimes in lieu of like something that's an entertaining product. But with the Minneapolis side, you know, the NBA was so regional, and some of the schools that were dominant in basketball in the area were smaller colleges, especially Hamlin. When the Minneapolis Lakers were first created from a team that got bought and moved over, they first looked to Hamlin for their coach. They tried to hire Joe Hutton, who was a famed Hamlin coach. He said no. And to think that a small college coach would say no to the NBA today is
Sure.
crazy. But back then, that was the more stable job. And then to find Joe Kunla, like that was the guy that eventually coached them. He's a Hall of Famer. He's recognized as one of the greatest coaches of all time. He was coaching at St. Thomas, another small college coach. And just the ties to small college alums because it was such a regional team. And also ties to the Star Tribune
Yeah,
because,
Sid.
yeah, Sid Hartman was asked to be the general manager of the team when they first moved. He was the one who bought the team and really brought them into Minneapolis and the key driver for that. But he preferred to write at the paper and stay in the shadows, didn't want to give up that job. So the man they hired to run the team was Max Winter, who more, Minnesotans probably know from his Vikings days, but he was someone who played basketball at Hamlin College, small college athlete. And then when the team moved from Minnesota to Los Angeles, the GM that took them there was a guy by the name of Blue Mose, who was a St. Thomas grad and a local Minnesota person. So lots of ties.
Absolutely. And I love all the Sid stories. Obviously, Sid. Yeah, I wouldn't think you'd find a lot of people these days who are both newspaper columnists and NBA GMs at the same time, but you never know, right? You never know. Bill Simmons wanted to do it back in the day, so we'll never know if it'll never happen again. Ben Kaplan, really enjoying this conversation. Just a couple more things. A, where can we get this book? And B, kind of if you have like a vision of like who the audience is for this book. I feel like you can kind of like go super deep. Like this is probably for like the NBA, the deep NBA people, but also it feels like you can kind of pick out chapters or just kind of like human interest level too. So who are you thinking of when you wrote this book?
Yeah. So we wrote this book for anybody interested in basketball. I think any NBA fan is going to find something on almost every page that they didn't know. That was one of our goals in writing this. And it's certainly not just for Division III athletes or fans of Division III. It's really for the NBA fan. And then beyond that, I think there are so many lessons that in researching and writing it that we took from a leadership perspective and from like a career perspective that, you know, even if you're just someone that's trying to figure out how to navigate your own career or figure out how to be a better leader, there's so many lessons in this that are good takeaways that, you know, obviously being a sports fan helps, but certainly a wider audience. And yeah, it's coming out April 16th, available for pre-order now on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, anywhere you want to get books. And it should be in stores just in a few weeks here.
Sounds great. Well, Ben Kaplan, congrats on the book. Again, the title, Pipeline to the Pros, How D3 Small College Nobodies Rose to Rule the NBA. For your sake and for the sake of Wolves fans, I sure hope you get a long playoff run from a lot of these guys, especially, like I said, not out of the realm of possibility that you get a Brad Stevens, Chris Finch finals, but we're getting ahead of ourselves there. But both those guys have had a good run this year and obviously some good runs beyond that. So congrats. Best of luck with the book in the future, you and Danny Parkins. And hopefully we'll talk again somewhere down the road.
Sounds good. Yeah. Hope to talk sometime before the finals. Thanks for having me.
Hope you enjoyed that conversation with Ben Kaplan. Exciting new book, like we talked about, coming out today, Pipeline to the Pros. I'm interested in reading the whole thing. I read quite a bit of it just to prepare for that interview, especially the parts about Chris Finch and, you know, the Lakers connections, things like that. But I love going deep on that kind of sports history stuff, especially when it's stuff I don't know. And this is definitely stuff I just didn't know. It's an interesting subject. And like we talked about, relevant to the Timberwolves right now. And like we talked about, it would be sure be fun for Wolves fans if I had a chance to talk to Ben later on in the playoffs, late May, something like that. If somehow, some way, it was Celtics, Wolves in the finals, and you had a couple of D3 guys, Brad Stevens and Chris Finch, leading those teams into the finals. But the Wolves have a long way to go for that. Like Patrick and I talked about Monday, the Suns are not a great matchup at all. 0-3 against the Suns this season, so we'll see how they are able to do with that. Let us finish with the cooler quickly. I saw another mock draft suggesting the Vikings are going to trade up to number 5 with the Chargers and that they're going to have to give up both of this year's number 1 picks and the 2025 first round pick just to move up to 5 to take JJ McCarthy. Early on, that was the price to move up to 3 to take Drake May. Now that seems to be the price to take J.J. McCarthy at number 5, and that the Drake May price might even be higher than that. At least this is according to, you know, what we're reading, what we're seeing, things like that. God, that feels like too much for J.J. McCarthy, doesn't it? Can you imagine trading with the Chargers, trading with J.J. McCarthy's former college coach, Jim Harbaugh, who could have been the Vikings coach a couple years ago, and he's getting 3 first-round picks for the quarterback that he coached in college. That would be something else. He's just so much of an unknown commodity. You got to be sure. I don't know. Like we've talked about plenty of times, you got to know that if you do this, it's going to be the defining move of your tenure, and you've got to get it right. But also, if you do get it right, nobody's probably going to remember what you had to give up. So I'm torn. That feels like too much for J.J. McCarthy. I don't have the same faith there that I have in Drake May. He's got the intangibles. He can make the throws, things like that. I just haven't seen him do it all the way at all these levels. So we'll see where it all ends up at that mock draft. It was the Mel Kiper Jr., Field Yates kind of going back and forth on ESPN. That caught my eye again. Another mock suggesting 3 firsts just to move up to 5. That feels like a heavy, heavy price to pay. We'll talk to Tom Curran about that on Wednesday's show. Like I said, insider for NBC Sports from the Boston area, covers the Patriots. That should be a great show. We'll see what he thinks the price is to move up to 3. We'll see what he thinks the likelihood of the Patriots moving off that pick is at this point. Lots of good stuff, I'm sure, coming up with him. Until then, I am Michael Rand. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday.